Okay, so let's dive deep into this stack of sources you've shared with us. You know, when we hear the word pirate, it conjures up a very specific image, doesn't it?
It really does. Eye patches, parrots, buried treasure, that whole thing.
Exactly. Mostly from like the Caribbean Golden Age stories we all know.
But this material you've put together, it takes us somewhere completely different.
Yeah, where's that?
Well, it paints a picture of a less discussed, but honestly, just as dramatic history of piracy, but in the Indian Ocean, specifically focusing quite a bit on the Malabar coast of India.
Ah, okay. So not the Caribbean at all.
Not primarily, no. And this wasn't just some flash in the pan. Your sources show it was this constant, really complex thing shaping maritime life there for centuries.
And it wasn't just like random bandits on boats, was it? From what I'm seeing in these notes,
Yeah.
it seems much more involved.
Oh, absolutely. Your collection digs into specific major incidents, some really powerful historical figures from the region.
And this bit I found fascinating, how the term pirate itself was defined and used.
Yes. That's a huge theme here. The definition wasn't fixed, you know. Often it was a label.
A label applied by.
By those in power, essentially, to describe anyone who challenged their control or operated outside their rules.
Okay, that's a really key insight right there. So our mission for this deep dive, working from this material you've brought together, is to pull out the most important nuggets, the most surprising facts. Basically, give you, the listener, a shortcut to getting your head around this complex topic you're curious about.
Exactly. We'll look at just how common this raiding was around India, highlight some key players. The Angrias are a big one here.
Right, I saw them mentioned prominently.
We'll examine the impacts on trade, on colonialism, explore how piracy was defined, the lore around it.
And you mentioned figures, even female pirates.
Well, the sources you provided do touch on women in piracy globally, and there's one absolutely remarkable example we can discuss, drawing straight from these accounts.
Okay, great. So it sounds like we need to look beyond the Hollywood version.
Definitely. This journey, based on your sources, shows maritime history is way more than just trade routes and big navies. It's about violence, sure, but also about law, power, identity, all clashing out there on the water.
All right, let's get started then. Where do we begin?
Well, I think the first thing to establish, based on your sources, is that piracy in the Indian Ocean, especially along the Malabar coast, it wasn't just an occasional problem.
That is a nuisance.
No, it was persistent, like an ingrained feature of life at sea there for centuries. And importantly, it wasn't something imported from Europe. It had really deep local roots.
And your material points to a specific group that embodies this local power, right? The Angria clan.
That's right, the Angrias. They come up again and again.
So who were they? Why are they so significant in these accounts?
Well, they built this incredibly formidable power base, strategically centered around Bombay, modern-day Mumbai, of course.
Okay. Near a major trading hub.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They weren't just hiding out. They established actual territory, building and holding fortresses along the coast.
Right. The sources mention Vijayanagara specifically as their main stronghold.
Yes, Vijayadurg. And the description of it really tells you something about their strength. It's noted, and this is a quote here, as being so impenetrable that it never fell during a several-year succession of fierce British attacks.
Wow. Wait, say that again. It never fell to the British, despite years of attacks.
That's what the source states. Fierce attacks over several years, and the British couldn't take it.
That's astonishing. That's not a pirate gang's hideout. That's a serious military fortification.
Precisely. It shows they were a real power. And from bases like this, they controlled the coastal waters.
And what were they doing? The sources detail their activities, right?
They did. And it's interesting. They were definitely targeting ships of the English East India Company.
Okay, so directly challenging the big European player in the region.
Yes, that immediately signals they were a barrier, or at least a major obstacle, to European expansion and trade
But
dominance.
it wasn't only the EIC, was it?
No. And this is crucial for understanding their complexity. Your sources say they also harassed Indian shippers.
Ah, okay. So it wasn't purely about resisting foreigners.
It seems not entirely. They were operating within a regional system, and part of that involved, well, extracting wealth and asserting control over local trade, too.
So kind of running their own coastal dominion, like a state within a state.
You could almost see it that way. The sources mentioned they demanded protection money, essentially, fees from ships wanting to use the port of Bombay.
Really? They were taxing ships using Bombay.
That's what's indicated. If you wanted safe passage in their waters, or presumably to use the port without hassle, you had to pay the angriest.
And they could back this up.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Your material gives a really striking example. Kanhoji Angria, a key leader. In 1716, he actually blockaded the port of Bombay.
Blockaded it. The whole port.
Yes. And held it for ransom.
Holding Bombay hostage in 1716, that's playing hardball. That's a direct military and economic challenge to the East India Company's entire operation there.
It absolutely was. It forced the English to negotiate, to treat the Angries as a serious power, not just dismiss them as simple pirates.
Which leads to this other really interesting point from the sources about how they were viewed.
Yes, the perception issue is fascinating.
Because despite them attacking Indian ships too, the sources say they are remembered in India with a certain affection. Why?
For their efforts, which at least temporarily frustrated the spread of British influence and control. That's the key part of the quote.
So even though they were raiders, their resistance against the growing British power kind of overshadowed that for some local people.
It seems that way. They were viewed, perhaps partly in hindsight, as defenders of local autonomy, even if their methods were, shall we say, coercive and self-interested.
That contrast is so important, isn't it? How they were seen locally versus how, presumably, the British saw them.
Exactly. It perfectly sets up this whole issue of who gets called a pirate and why. It's often in the eye of the beholder, or rather, the pen of the powerful.
So the Angrias represent this strong local force operating in a really complex maritime world.
A world where European powers were becoming increasingly dominant, not just as targets, but as the ones trying to set the rules of the sea.
Okay, that's a perfect transition, because this brings us to one of the most famous, or maybe infamous, incidents in global pirate history, right? One detailed in your sources.
You mean the Ganges Away?
That's the one. Tell us about that. It sounds dramatic.
Oh, it was incredibly dramatic. And it had huge repercussions. This wasn't just any merchant ship.
No. Whose was it?
It belonged to the Grand Mogul Fleet.
The Moguls?
Yeah.
The Emperor Aurangzeb's fleet, one of the biggest empires in the world then.
Exactly. This ship, the Ganges Sowai, is sometimes even called the Great Pilgrimage Ship.
A pilgrimage ship?
Yes. It's believed it often carried pilgrims, possibly sailing from the major Mogul port of Surat towards Mocha in the Red Sea, a key route for the Hajj. So attacking, it wasn't just attacking trade. It was attacking something religiously significant and directly challenging the Mughal emperor's authority and prestige.
Wow. And who was daring enough to do that?
The pirate was the legendary or notorious Henry Avery, sometimes known as Avery.
Avery, I've heard that name. A big figure in the Golden Age, right?
One of the biggest. This happened in 1695 with Avery commanding his ship, the Fancy.
And your sources have details about the actual attack.
They do, including accounts from contemporary observers. One particularly vivid description comes from Muhammad Hashim Kafi Khan.
Who was he?
An Indian historian who was actually in Surat when the news broke. So he's relaying contemporary reports and reactions. His account is quoted in your material.
What does he say happened?
It sounds like chaos. He describes the ship's captain, Ibrahim, when Avery's pirates boarded. Apparently, Ibrahim ran below decks.
Ran away.
Well, according to Kafi Khan, he ran below, armed the slave girls who were on board, and sent them up to fight the pirates.
He sent the slave girls to fight? That's unbelievable.
It's an astonishing detail, isn't it? It speaks volumes about the desperation, maybe the panic, on board.
Did Kafi Khan think highly of Captain Ibrahim?
Not at all. He's quite scathing, actually. Your sources quote him directly blaming Ibrahim for the loss. He wrote that, "The Christians, meaning the pirates, are not bold in the use of the sword, and there were so many weapons on board the imperial vessel that if the captain had made any resistance, they must have been defeated."
Ouch. So he thought they could have won if the captain had been braver.
That was his assessment. A pretty harsh judgment.
But did the crew fight back at all?
It seems they did. Your sources also mentioned Captain Ibrahim's own report later, where he defended himself. He claimed his crew fought hard and that many of the enemy were sent to hell.
Suggesting they inflicted casualties on Avery's pirates.
Exactly. Although the sources note uncertainty about the actual number of pirate casualties. Estimates from the time apparently ranged wildly from just a few to over 100.
That uncertainty itself is interesting. Hard to get the true story.
Very true in these chaotic situations. But ultimately, despite any resistance, the Ganges Sowai did surrender after several hours.
And the loot. It must have been immense if it was a Mughal treasure ship.
Immense is an understatement. But here again, your sources highlight something interesting. The figures reported at the time varied wildly.
How wildly?
Well, the two main figures cited are 325,000 pounds.
Okay, which is already a fortune.
And 600,000 pounds.
600,000 pounds in 1695 money. That's astronomical. What the huge difference?
Your material offers some plausible explanations. The higher figure, the 600,000 pounds, apparently came from the Mughal authorities.
Okay.
And it suggested they might have, let's say, exaggerated the value.
Why would they do that?
Well, they were demanding compensation from the English. Because Every was English, the Mughals held the English East India Company responsible for his actions. A higher claimed loss means a bigger compensation demand.
Ah, politics and money. Makes sense. So the EIC probably claimed the lower figure.
Exactly. Your sources say the EIC estimated the loss at the 325,000-pound figure. They'd naturally want to minimize the payout they were facing.
Were there any other estimates?
The material mentions a contemporary Scottish merchant, Alexander Hamilton, whose estimate apparently supported the lower figure, though, you know, historians always caution about relying on just one account.
But regardless of the exact number, hundreds of thousands of pounds, it was a massive haul.
Unimaginably huge for the time, and the impact went far beyond the money.
How so?
It was a major blow to Mughal prestige, a deep humiliation. It showed that even their most important ships, possibly carrying pilgrims, were vulnerable on routes they considered their own.
And this caused problems between the Mughals and the English.
Big problems. It led to a diplomatic crisis. The Mughals clamped down on EIC activities, demanded reparations. It seriously strained relations and highlighted the risks the company faced from piracy, even piracy committed by their own countrymen.
So this one incident really reverberated.
Absolutely. And it ties into that broader theme of Europeans trying to control the sea lanes. Your sources mentioned another Mughal ship, the Rahimi, also sailing from Surat to Mocha.
What about it?
It apparently found it necessary to obtain a kartaz.
A kartaz? What's that?
It was basically a pass, a permit to sail, issued by European authorities. In this case, the source mentions the Portuguese.
So even Mughal ships needed permission from Europeans to sail in those waters.
It seems so. And the source describes the kartaz as being overpriced, but all the same compulsory.
Compulsory. So they had to buy it.
That's the implication. It shows how European powers, even before formal empire, were using these systems to exert control, to police the seas, collect revenue, and basically define who had the right to trade freely. It's a subtle form of dominance.
Okay, so you have the angriest challenging the EIC locally, every hitting the Mughal flagship on a grand scale, and this underlying kartaz system. It paints a picture of the Indian Ocean as this arena of conflict over trade and control.
Absolutely. A complex struggle involving local powers, huge empires, and these rising European companies. And that struggle is central to understanding how piracy got defined.
Right. Let's dive into that definition aspect, because your sources seem to suggest it's not straightforward at all.
Not in the slightest. It's maybe the most fascinating part of this whole story.
Where does the European idea come from? You mentioned hostis humani generis.
Yes, that's the classical Latin term, meaning common enemy of all humankind. Your sources trace it back to Roman thinkers like Cicero. It basically meant pirates were outside the law of any nation, enemies of everyone.
Giving anyone the right to hunt them down, basically.
Pretty much. It provided a powerful legal justification. But your material immediately pairs this with that brilliant parable.
The one about Alexander the Great.
Yes. Attributed to St. Augustine. It's such a classic. Alexander captures a pirate.
And asks him by what right he dares to infest the sea.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the pirate's reply, quoted in your sources, is just perfect. What do you mean by seizing the whole earth? But because I do it with a petty ship, I am called a robber, while you who do it with a great fleet are styled emperor.
Boom. That just cuts right through it, doesn't it?
It really does. It forces you to ask. Is the label pirate about the act itself, or is it about the scale and the power of the person doing it? Is the only difference between a pirate and an emperor the size of their forces?
A question that resonates through history.
Yeah.
And European law tried to draw a line, right?
Mm-hmm.
Between pirates and privateers.
Yes. That was the key legal distinction they developed. A pirate acts purely for private gain without any government authority. A privateer, on the other hand, holds a commission.
A letter of marque?
Exactly. A license from a government allowing them to attack enemy shipping during wartime. They were, theoretically, state-sanctioned agents of warfare at sea.
Theoretically? But did it work out so neatly?
Not really. Your sources describe the situation created by privateering as a vast gray zone.
A gray zone? How so?
Well, think about it. One country's enemy is another country's ally. So a privateer attacking Spanish ships with an English letter of marque might look very much like a pirate to the Spanish.
Right, perspective matters.
And these letters of marque became surprisingly easy to get. Your sources mentioned they were even issued to foreigners. This created a whole class of what the material calls nationally unattached privateers, kind of like mercenaries of the sea, with very thin legal cover.
Okay, I can see how that gets messy.
And then what happens when the wars end?
Uh-oh. All these armed sailors are out of a job.
Exactly. Thousands of trained, experienced, armed seafarers, often operating far from home, suddenly unemployed. Their licenses are no longer valid. What do many of them do?
Turn to independent raiding.
Precisely. They keep doing what they know, but now without any state sanction. Your sources argue this is a major factor behind the explosion of globalized European piracy in the so-called Golden Age. The system meant to control violence at sea actually ended up fueling widespread piracy.
That's ironic. Does your material give an example of someone caught in this gray zone?
It mentions a figure named George Cusack, described as a former soldier or mercenary.
What did he do?
He apparently operated with a counterfeit letter of marque, so pretending to be a privateer. But because he attacked ships from multiple nations, not just a designated enemy, he crossed the line.
And became.
He was deemed hostis humani generis, a common enemy. His case shows how fluid those boundaries were. And there's a little detail about his crew supposedly singing a defiant drinking song.
Adds to the pirate image, huh?
It does. Cusack kind of embodies how the privateering system could backfire and produce the very pirates it was supposed to be distinct from.
Okay, so that's the complex European background. How did this framework get applied or maybe misused in the Indian Ocean context, according to your sources?
This is where it gets really pointed, especially regarding the colonial dynamic. As European trading companies like the EIC gained power, they started acting like maritime police.
Setting themselves up as the authorities.
Pretty much. And in doing so, they imposed their own definitions of what was legitimate activity at sea.
So anyone operating outside their rules?
Like local cheats, or groups like the Angrias who resisted their control, or anyone who didn't buy their cartas. Their actions were labeled as arbitrary and antithetical to trade.
Meaning
they were branded as pirates, lawless criminals operating outside the norms of civilized commerce as defined by the Europeans.
But your sources argue this wasn't just a neutral description.
No, the argument presented is that this labeling was strategic. It served to mask the European companies' own aggressive expansion and their push for monopolies.
Also,
by painting local resistance or alternative economic activity as piracy, they could justify using military force against it. They could justify seizing control of trade routes, pushing local players out.
And the sources suggest this could even lead to dispossession, forcing communities into raiding.
Yes, that argument is made that by destroying traditional livelihoods or restricting access to trade, European actions sometimes pushed coastal communities towards raiding out of sheer economic necessity. Then they could point to that raiding as proof of inherent lawlessness. It's a vicious cycle.
Creating a clear double standard in how people were perceived?
A very clear one. Your sources contrast how European figures like Every or even William Kidd, who's mentioned briefly in a philosophical context involving John Locke, might be viewed with some ambiguity back in Europe.
Sometimes extolled as brave pirates and comprehended as privateers, as the quote puts it.
Exactly. Reflecting that gray zone we talked about. But Indian figures, like the dreaded Angria or the Malwans, described as a nest of vipers.
They were just...
lawless pirates, placed firmly outside the pale of law and civilized principles of commerce in the dominant European narratives. No ambiguity allowed.
Was this view universal among Europeans at the time?
Mostly, but your sources do mention an exception. Colonel Alexander Walker, late 18th century.
What did he say?
He apparently saw more complexity. Despite the prevailing colonial attitudes, he suggested that raiding wasn't always just innate wickedness, but was often driven by basic needs, opportunity, want, and poverty.
Acknowledging the socioeconomic factors, that's quite insightful for the time.
It is. But his seems to have been a minority view. The dominant narrative served the colonial project.
This whole analysis really makes you rethink the term pirate. It wasn't just a description of an action. It was a judgment, a political tool.
Very much so. And your sources show this wasn't unique to India. The label was used elsewhere as a tool for colonial control.
Like where?
Southeast Asia comes up.
Yeah.
Your material mentions figures like Stamford Raffles in the 19th century.
The founder of Singapore.
Yes. He and others promoted the idea that piracy was endemic in the region, linked to so-called failed states.
And this idea was used to justify
European intervention, military action, taking control. But your sources critique this view, arguing it was driven more by colonial ideology, the need to justify expansion, than by a clear-eyed assessment of the local political realities.
It sounds like the situation on the ground was often more complicated than just pirates versus states.
Definitely. The Bugis Makassar people are given as an example.
Who were they?
A maritime people from Sulawesi. Their activities, according to your sources, really blurred the lines. They were traders, they were mercenaries fighting for different local rulers, and they engaged in raiding that Europeans call piracy.
So complex actors, not just simple outlaws.
Exactly. They're described sometimes as political entrepreneurs using their maritime skills to carve out power bases. Their story really highlights that porous line between state-condoned warfare and sheer piracy, especially in regions with different political structures than Europe.
It wasn't just Europeans trying to control the seas, though, right? Did Indian powers develop their own strategies?
Yes, that's an important point raised in your sources. The Marathas, for example, who were a major rising power in India.
What did they do?
Your material mentions a specific document, the Ajnapatra from 1715. It outlines their plans to build a navy.
Why?
Explicitly to protect their trade and to counter threats, including threats from European powers. So Indian states were absolutely developing their own maritime strategies and perspectives on sea control.
And the pirate label was used in other contexts, too, even on land.
Apparently so. Your sources give the example of the French calling Vietnamese resistance fighters pirates, even when they were operating inland. It became a general term to delegitimize any opposition.
And in the Philippines?
The Spanish used the term Moro pirate. Your material points out this was a label with colonial origins, often applied broadly to multi-ethnic groups with diverse motivations, lumping complex identities and histories under one negative term.
Okay, so if we pull all this together, the sources are really showing that the word pirate, especially in this era, it's loaded.
Extremely loaded.
Yeah.
Who got called a pirate and the often severe consequences of that label depended hugely on who held the power, who controlled the narrative, and whose definition of legitimate activity won out.
It's as much about power and perception as it is about actual robbery on the high seas.
Precisely. And beyond the history and the politics, there's also the idea of the pirate, the cultural image, which your sources touch on.
Right. That Alexander and the pirate story again. It seems to capture this enduring fascination with the parallel between the small-time robber and the big-time conqueror.
It does. And European ideas about pirates from their own golden age sometimes included images of, you know, opulence and drunkenness, that defiant attitude we saw hinted at with Cusack's crew, a certain rebellious glamour, maybe?
Mixed with condemnation, though, your sources mentioned the philosopher John Locke using the pirate as an example of someone outside the law, outside the social contract.
Yes, they were seen as representing lawless violence, a threat to the order states were trying to impose, but still a figure that captured the imagination.
And that imagination fueled fiction, didn't it?
Absolutely. Piracy became a huge genre. And your material notes that sometimes, especially in colonial settings, this fiction was used to exoticize and demonize the other. Like the French, La Grande Piraterie, stories about Vietnam, using piracy narratives to reinforce colonial stereotypes.
So the idea of the pirate is just as complex and contested as the historical reality, shaped by law, philosophy, culture, and power.
Definitely. Which brings us to a specific question you raised about female pirates.
Yes. Did the sources you are given mention any from the Indian context, like the Angrias?
You know, the specific materials focused on the Indian coastline didn't detail local female figures in that role. However, the collection did include information on women in piracy more generally.
Okay.
And it highlights one example who is, well, absolutely staggering. Truly remarkable.
Who are we talking about?
We need to shift focus slightly, geographically and chronologically, to the South China Sea in the early 19th century. The figure is Zheng Yi Sao.
Zheng Yi Sao, also known as Qing Shi, right?
That's the one. Her story, as presented in your sources, is just extraordinary.
What's the story?
She was initially the wife of a powerful pirate commander, Zheng Yi. He led a huge fleet, but he died in 1807.
And she?
She didn't just step aside. She took command. Full command of his entire organization, the powerful Red Flag Fleet.
Took command herself. How big was this fleet?
This is where the numbers get almost unbelievable. Your sources state that at her peak, around 1805, which is slightly before her husband died, suggesting she was influential. Even then, the fleet she ultimately commanded numbered 400 junks and between 40,000 and 60,000 pirates.
Wait, 40 to 60,000 pirates.
40 to 60,000.
Under one commander. A woman commander.
Yes, it's a staggering number. Think about it, that's bigger than many national armies or navies of the time. This wasn't a pirate crew, it was a massive maritime confederation.
So she wasn't just a raider, she was a major political and military power.
Absolutely. Your sources say she dominated the South China Sea, both militarily and politically. She wasn't just reacting, she was setting the agenda in that region.
Did she impose any kind of order within this huge force?
Apparently so. The sources mention she enforced various pirate codes.
Codes, like rules.
Yes. And one specific rule mentioned is particularly striking. She made the rape of female captives punishable by death.
Wow. That challenges the stereotype of pirates being completely lawless, especially regarding captives. It suggests a real attempt at discipline and control.
It certainly does. It points to a level of organization and perhaps a different set of internal ethics than often assumed.
Given her power, she must have faced serious opposition.
Oh, absolutely. Not just from the Chinese authorities, the Qing government, but also from the major European powers active there. The sources mention the British East India Company and the Portuguese Empire trying to deal with her. She was an international problem for them.
So how did her story end? Did they eventually defeat her, capture her?
This is perhaps the most incredible part. Unlike most famous pirates whose careers ended violently, Zheng Yi Cao managed something extraordinary.
What happened?
In 1810, she negotiated a surrender.
Negotiated with the authorities?
Yes. And not just any surrender. She negotiated terms that allowed her and many of her followers amnesty. And she herself was allowed to retire in peace.
She retired. After commanding 60,000 pirates and fighting empires, she just retired peacefully.
That's what the sources state. It's a truly remarkable end to such a powerful career in such a violent world.
That story is amazing. It completely blows up the typical pirate narrative. A woman commanding on that scale, achieving that level of political influence, and then securing a peaceful retirement.
It really does. It shows that leadership, power, and strategic acumen in this world weren't confined to men. Her story adds a whole other dimension to understanding historical piracy.
Definitely broadens the picture. Okay, this has been incredibly rich. Let's try to wrap up and pull together the main takeaways from this deep dive into your source material.
Sounds good. I think, first off, we've clearly seen that piracy in the Indian Ocean, especially around the Malabar coast, wasn't just a footnote. It was a major, long-lasting phenomenon with deep local roots involving significant players like the Angrias.
Right. And big incidents like Henry Every's capture of the Ganji Sawai weren't just isolated robberies. They were major events with huge consequences for trade, for empires like the Mughals, and for international relations, especially with the rising European powers.
And perhaps the most crucial thread running through all of this, based on your sources, is how slippery the definition of piracy actually was.
Yeah, it wasn't just a simple legal term. It was often a label, a tool used by the powerful, particularly colonial powers, to define who was legitimate, who was outside the law, and to justify their own actions and control over trade.
The contrast between how European privateers or pirates were sometimes viewed versus how figures like the Angrias were portrayed really highlights that power dynamic in defining who's the robber and who's the emperor, to echo that old parable.
And we touched on the cultural idea of the pirate, too, that mix of fear, fascination, and sometimes a tool for exoticizing or demonizing others in fiction and colonial narratives.
And finally, the example of Zheng Yi Cao, though outside the immediate Indian context detailed in some sources, just shatters stereotypes. It shows the incredible scale piracy could reach and that women could not only participate but command at the very highest levels, achieving significant political power.
So for you, the listener, hopefully this deep dive, pulling directly from the sources you shared, has given you a real shortcut to understanding this complex, often overlooked slice of global history. It's much more than just treasure maps.
It really is.
Yeah.
It's a history that reveals the oceans weren't just empty spaces for ships to cross, but were active zones of conflict, negotiation, and struggle over power, law, and who got to define the rules.
Which leaves us with a final thought to mull over, maybe. Considering how often throughout history and maybe even today, groups that challenge established power or operate outside dominant economic or political systems get labeled pirates, terrorists, rogue states. What does this specific history of maritime violence and the fight over defining it tell us about how we understand and label conflict and control in our own world, whether it's happening on land or at sea?
That's a really potent question to think about. How much do those historical patterns of labeling based on power still resonate today?